Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a prevention conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Prevention, as in let's prevent disease before it starts. That is what primary prevention means. Do you believe that we can prevent kids from using drugs and alcohol? I want to take you around the world to a place that proved that such a goal is not a fantasy, but reality. The headlines in 2017 was Iceland knows how to stop teen substance use, but the rest of the world is not listening. What is Iceland doing that's so special? In 1997, 40% of Iceland's adolescents got drunk in the past 30 days, one of the highest teen alcohol problem in the world. But after a national prevention program consistent over 20 years, the trend has now reversed to just 5%. That's pretty astonishing. A side effect of the program also measured decreased tobacco, cannabis, as well as decreased bullying, violence, theft, and sexual abuse. What is Iceland's secret? To learn more about Iceland's successful prevention initiative, I reached out all the way to Iceland to Dr. Ingadóra Sigfúsdóttir. Dr. Ingadóra Sigfúsdóttir is a professor of sociology in Iceland, and she also practices in Colombia and New York City and Stockholm, Sweden. She's the founder of the Icelandic Center of Social Research and Analysis. She reached the Order of the Falcon Award, one of the highest honors of the Republic of Iceland awarded by the president. She got that for her work on the field of prevention. She shares the common dream of creating a better life for young people. To learn more about Dr. Ingadóra Sigfúsdóttir, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Ingadóra Sigfúsdóttir, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much, and thanks for including me in this really very important program that you have.
Yes, and I'm so excited to have you from all the way from Iceland, really the gold standard for the world in terms of drug prevention in youth. You have proven that this is possible. And a shout out to Dan Heath, who connected us. Dan is the author of a book called Upstream, and he talks about all these upstream measures of prevention. Instead of like picking up people as they're drowning, you know, in the river, you stop for a minute, go upstream, figure out the problem, and you could save a lot more people. That's exactly what you did for Iceland, and I'm so excited to learn from you.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Yeah, no, that's the key. That's the key kind of image that you have in your mind, you know, instead of like trying to save them from drowning, just keep them from not being in danger of entering the right. Water.
Right. And that's what I do as an emergency physician. I'm way downstream, right? Picking up people by ambulance in the emergency department, extremely expensive. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And what you would do is way upstream and really want people to learn from you. But first, let's take a few moments to get to know you better. You are a sociologist in Iceland. What made you choose that career, and how did you develop from that to working on prevention, drug prevention in youth?
It's a complicated story, you know. I'm a sociologist by training. Kind of my PhD is in sociology / psychology / public health, you know. So I am sort of like, I'm in the kind of midst of different fields. And I started out by learning sociology. And then I went to Penn State University, where I did my PhD. And at the time, I had been working with my mentor, who was a specialist in adolescent, how to decrease the likelihood of substance use among adolescents. And from there, I took another degree in psychology and then in public health. So I have a mixed background, you know. My mother asked me once, when are you sure you're not going to go into dentistry? And I said, no.
You are collecting degrees. You're, professional.
Yeah, but it has come, you know, it's been really helpful. And so it's been having this mixed background has become my theme, reading literature from different fields. And so that is, that's actually very important. The reason for why I got so interested in evidence-based policy making was that in the beginning of the 1990s, I was working at this research center with my mentor, and I was also political advisor to the Minister of Education in Iceland. And the Ministry of Education was creating a policy on gender equality in schools. And the focus was all on the girls. And at the same time, I was working with the data within the research center. And I saw that it didn't add up because the girls were fine, but the boys were doing bad. So I became really interested in evidence-based policy making, you know, just like, you know, what may sound as a good idea, as in just like telling kids to say no to drugs, it doesn't work. So I became an enthusiast on evidence-based policy making.
Yeah. So I want to get into that more, but you said you've also had a very rich and challenging life. You have 6 children, and I'm wondering if within your children or personal life, you've seen substance use or excessive drinking, and that's what helped drive you to this mission.
Yeah, I mean, my goal has been to kind of create a comparative data set for the whole world, for kids all over the world, because I believe that kids are all the same, that people are all the same wherever we are. And I have tried that and tested by having 3 biological daughters who are just my daughters. And then I have 3 foster children, one girl from Iceland and two boys from Kurdistan, from Iraq. And of course, it turns out that they're all similar, but they come in with, we are so environmentally based. We are so like influenced by the environment. Like genes are, yes, they do have a role, but you know, if you ask a 7-year-old, what do you want to become when you grow up? You get answers like, I want to become a pilot or a teacher or something. You never get the answer, I'm going to become a active substance user. I'm going to become a drug addict. No, that it doesn't, it's not like a decision that they make. They find themselves in a group of other kids who are doing it, and it happens, you know. So my role has been on not like focusing on each individual mindset, as in within psychology, as in like we had before we started our work, we had a lot of prevention programs being run, as in teaching kids about the negative sides of substance use, teaching them to say no to drugs. And it turns out that that doesn't work. What you need to do is to change the community around the kid. The kid is the key, and you change the community around the kids in order for that kid not having to use drugs. Because, you know, if they have a choice of playing games, playing a good soccer game with their peers, or just being somewhere using substances, they choose the soccer game. That's so my role has been like as a sociologist to change the environment so that they do not need to use the choice of using drugs.
Right. And that sounds so hard or impossible to do, but yet you did it. So let's start the Iceland story from the beginning. 1997, you had 40% of Icelander teens got drunk in the past 30 days. Was that the trigger? What was the trigger that started the whole story in working on prevention?
Yeah, that was the trigger. We really had a great problem. We were among the highest when it came to binge drinking among adolescents, and comparing countries, we were among the highest in Europe. And there had been a lot of prevention programs being run at the time, just like, you know, teach them to say no to drugs. And it turned out that that was not working. So I was working as a young researcher at the time with my mentor, Thor Thorlinson, who's actually kind of the author of this program. And we decided to try out something new and different. We decided to gather researchers, policymakers, and practitioners who are working with kids and adolescents in the field, and see if we could come up with another way, because we were seeing like substance use going up, although, you know, we were doing all these prevention work. So that was the, so all over the news in Iceland at the time was that, you know, downtown Reykjavik is full of drunk kids, you know, every weekend, you know, drunk adolescents, and binge drinking was our key problem. So yeah, so that was the drive. We needed to come up with a new solution. But at the time when we started it, of course, we were just like, we were starting it. We didn't know whether it would work. It was based on three core elements. One was, we're not going to do anything that is not evidence-based. We're not going to do anything that is not based on science. The second was that we're not going to focus on each individual like kid. We're not going to say it's your responsibility to not drink or drink. You know, we're going to say we are responsible for these kids, whether we are parents, teachers, coaches, cops. We're responsible for creating a community where they do not have to use drugs. And the third key element was this dialogue between researchers, policymakers, and practitioners. Because researchers, like scientists, they often have this, you know, we just want to publish our papers and get them published and get tenure and get like, but this idea was, okay, yes, we're going to do that. We're going to publish papers, but we're going to gather data and we're going to have that data straight out into society so that it will work for the kids who are here right now. So because that makes parents interested in taking part, and because it's your kid who might be in danger.
Yeah. So that was your secret formula, is three pillars. One is research. We could do that. Yes. I think everybody does some research. Two is work on the community. That sounds really hard. And three, dialogue. I think there is, you know, that's doable. Dialogue between policy. A lot of times, at least I see in the United States, politicians and policymakers play doctor without asking doctors and make decisions. So that may not be as easy as it sounds. But then you started out with a lot of research, and you mentioned you studied protective and risk factors. Right?
Yeah.
So tell us what you learned about that.
Yeah. So when we started this in like around 1996, 97, we just like dug into the literature. We went through what others had done, and we started gathering data on, you know, what is it that, because if we're going to change something, we have to know what affects it, you know. So if we're going to change substance use among young people, we have to know what are the risk and protective factors. So we started doing studies. And we've been doing these studies on a yearly basis from 1997. And now, of course, not only in Iceland, but all over the world. And so we learned about what are the risk and protective factors. And if we can manage them, if we can kind of get a grasp of them. So for example, if I give you an example, within the family, there seem to be three key factors One is that your child needs to find that he or she is emotionally supported. The second thing is what we call positive monitoring, as in it's not rule setting. It's not saying, like, as in you're supposed to do this and this and not this, but it's more like knowing where they are on Saturday nights, knowing their friends, and knowing the parents of their friends. That's really good too. Just creating a network. And the third factor was, so it's emotional support, positive monitoring. And the third factor was just the quantity of time spent with your kids. This was not really popular in Iceland at the time, because we like to believe in this idea of just like, you know, you spend a little time with them over the weekend, like 1 or 2 hours, and but just like the quantity of time, just being there, that they know that they can reach you, that they have you in, and it does. You don't have to take them to museums or do any fancy stuff. Just watch a TV game, watch a soccer game with them. Just invest in their interests. That was the third key factor.
And I think that's really important. So when you talk about risk and perfect factors, as an individual, you may not have control, right? If you have a genetic predisposition for alcohol or drug use, we're not going to be able to control that. You didn't even look at the individual level. The next, you know, circle of influence you went to is parents, and then you looked at friends and community. But a role of parents is huge. And actually, I was, you know, studying up to talking to you, and I talked to a group from a Hispanic community, and the parents want to know, what can we do? And it's like, you could do a lot. And it's like, but the amount of time. And again, this is a community that prides itself in work with multiple jobs, and they're hardworking and they're not home. And you mentioned the same thing. That was the same culture in Iceland. People working multiple jobs, working really hard. They don't have time to be home.
Yeah, you know, and actually Icelanders have been measured, as in if they had a choice, and this was before when we were starting this, and this was not very popular, because if Icelanders had the choice of more work or more leisure time with their kids, they chose more work, you know, because we are kind of like, we have this working element in our history, you know. So but the good thing is this: parents are an important ingredient, but they are not necessarily 100% necessary. So if there are other people within the community that are willing to invest in your kids, that is the key. So we see, for example, for kids who are, and this is a paper we published some years ago, we see that for kids who are brought up in families where there is a lot of difficult things going on, arguments, violence, you know, those kids, you know, taking part in organized youth work and sports, the preventive factor of that is actually stronger for them than the kids who are brought up in normal families. So that gave us this hope that, like, yes, the, you know, parents are important, but they are like, if we can build a community that is willing to invest in this next generation, that the effect is stronger for those kids than for the kids who just are living in a regular home where there's breakfast and you know.
All right. So how did you go about doing that? How do you tell parents, okay, don't work so much, spend time with your kids, and they need to make a living? How did you change that culture?
Well, it took time. And I mean, we started this over 20 years ago. And I always remember this meeting that I showed up at in 1996. I was a young researcher, and it was Icelandic women are strong, you know. And it was a group of Icelandic women, and I was presenting this information that kind of like this evidence came as a little bit of a surprise to us, you know, that the quantity of time was such a strong protective factor. And I brought this into this group of strong Icelandic women, and they were not pleased with me, you know, because they thought kind of I was giving out the message that they should go back into the homes to take care of the kids. But that was not the message. The message was, we need to organize, we need to have a better, like, and now today, this has become so mainstream in Iceland that no one ever kind of thinks about, like, yeah, we're following the Icelandic model, but having good organized youth work after school, where they are, like, you know, taken care of by people who are investing in them, that's the key, you know. And of course, you know, this it took time. It was not always easy. And but when we started showing that this actually works, people came on board. And not only in Iceland, now it's run in, like, the program is run in 5 continents all over the world.
Interesting. So does that mean Iceland is paying for after-school programs in sports and music, dance and things?
Yeah, that's one of the wonderful thing about Iceland. Of course, Iceland is small, and we had politicians with us that were really believing in what we're doing. And so we have something that is called a prepaid leisure card. So the city or the community that you live in like pays upfront a certain amount that you then, you know, your kid can choose from if they want to go into soccer or handball or dancing or whatever, and then the community pays for it up to a certain point, which gives us this opportunity to take out this socioeconomic variable. So rich kids and poor kids, all they can all take part
of the same activities. Now, yes. The thing is, you've mentioned several times that the old programs, as I think specifically from the United States, of say no to drugs, didn't work. I'm wondering, you know, what the evidence is. I'm thinking of people like me and my generation and people that I talk to some of us, it actually did work, you know, like if you showed us black lungs of smokers, we were like, oh, I don't want my lungs to look like that. That for some people, that campaign worked. For some people, obviously, it didn't. What is it that you learned from those messages? What worked, what didn't? And how do you talk to kids now in an evidence-based way?
Well, okay, so the question is twofold. Mm-hmm. The former part is we did a lot of research on, because what the program that you're mentioning sounds like so sensible. I mean, I it's like, you know, just tell them not to just say no to drugs. And you, of course, you know, you're an educated doctor. And, it turns out when we go through the literature, and this has been tested in many, many places, that program, at least on its own, does not work, you know. And so, we tried this in, we've published papers on this in Spain, in Lithuania, in Chile, in very many different countries, and we see that even that teaching them about the negative sides of substance use can even make substance use more interesting, you know. The second part of your question was like, how do you deal with this? We never talk about substance use. We integrate them into programs and into like making their lives important, having them have a role in society and like feeling that their lives are important. But this whole program that we're running kind of never talks about substance use. It's all about changing the community around the kid and just like making it possible for them to do something else that they tend to choose. Rather than if they have nothing to do and just like are hanging around with friends,
I'm still wondering if them, and I want to hear more about, you know, the success of the Iceland model, but I can't help but thinking, you know, a few months ago where there was a boy in California, he was a wrestler. He got a scholarship to go to college with his wrestling. He was popular. He was funny. He had friends. He didn't have free time on his hands. But, you know, the frontal lobe of kids not quite developed, and they take risks. And he bought what he thought was a Xanax, but it wasn't Xanax. It was fentanyl, and he dropped dead. And I don't know if you don't have that problem with fentanyl. In Iceland or in Europe, thank goodness for you. But
not yet.
It's scary, and it's not scare tactics. It's just real. And I'm wondering, given, and the fact is, and again, and I don't know how the European model, but this generation of American kids has a lot more anxiety, depression, and those type of issues, that just having, you know, sports or activities after school, it's still hitting those kids.
Yeah. It's what we say is like each year that you can postpone them to take their first drink or to do the first something.
Cannabis.
That because substance use travels through generations, as in through cohorts. So we can see that. So getting them, getting the message to them as young as possible, and to getting the message to the parents of the kids who are young, each year that we can postpone them to take their first drink, if we just play just simply, that diminishes the likelihood of them, becoming substance users, a problematic substance users later on. But when you talk about one individual case, it can be so many variables behind this. So in Iceland, it's not about being an elite athlete. It's more about being a part of a community where your parents show up for your games, mm-hmm. or for whatever you're doing, whether it's music or just organized youth work, is a protective factor. And this is something that, came as a surprise to us when we started these studies in Eastern Europe. We saw that organized sport activities, which in Iceland is a protective factor, was actually a risk factor in many places in Eastern Europe. And we were puzzled over this, and we talked to people on spot and practitioners working with kids and adolescents, and they it turned out that just the whole organization of the so they kind of chose kids from young age that they thought would have talents to become really good. And they kind of took them out of their community and even took them, they went with buses to another neighborhood to play with other potential stars. But that doesn't work. It's all about the community and being a part of a community.
Well, I think the fact that you started this whole mission 20 years ago makes it a lot easier for now to deal with should such things as fentanyl come your way. Or the whole push of commercialized cannabis products. You're able to resist that better than other countries that haven't made that investment. So I'm curious, you don't talk ever about the dangers. This is your growing brain, why you don't want to, affect your growing brain, or this is what cannabis can do to your brain or body. You don't have that in your education at all.
Nope. We just try to keep them occupied with other things that are giving them pleasure without having to use substances. But it's not that Iceland is. Often we encounter ourselves with politicians who want to legalize marijuana, mm-hmm. and so we're in a constant fight. It's it's never. And there is so much money in this, you know, there is so much money for the people who are getting our kids addicted to drugs. And that's so we
call it the addiction for profit industry.
Yes. That's the thing. Yeah.
But you've been able to fight that successfully in Iceland.
Yes. Until now, we have. Yeah. We've been blessed by, like, you know, and it has been shown that it works in other places. It works in very different communities. So the same, I mean, people are all the same. Kids are all the same around the world. Parents are all the same around the world. We tend to want the best for our kids. And if there is a solution that, you know, there is, like, we can decrease the likelihood of your kid becoming a substance user, it's easy to get people on board. So that is one of the good things about this program. It's easy to get politicians. 20 years back, when I was starting working on this, this was called soft matter, you know. This was like not kind of like, but now there, wherever I go, there's not a politician who doesn't want to be linked to that, you know, who doesn't want to own that idea of creating a better future for next generation.
Right. And you've had that success. You have the data to prove it. What you said, like 40% use of binge drinking in 1997 to now you said 5%. That's incredible.
Yeah. And it travels through cohorts. So now we see that kids who are about 20, they use less alcohol than 14-year-old kids 20 years ago. So it travels through
people, and then you also, and it's not just substance use, right? You found it as far as violence and bullying and not just alcohol, even though your main problem was alcohol, but you also see that success in cannabis.
Yes. And in other kinds of all kinds of behavior related to substance use, to alcohol use, you know, we see bullying going down, sexual abuse, violence, so
everything else,
yeah. So it follows, it goes together.
Amazing. So you kind of hinted that Iceland is getting a pressure on marijuana legalization. United States has a huge market. Europe has a huge market. How is Iceland managing that?
Well, we are, fortunately, there is a strong group here. Every once in a while, we get a politician or politicians who say, hey, you know, why not? Let's do it. But fortunately, we have a strong kind of prevention group that fights back, you know. And
what would happen if marijuana was legalized in Iceland? You still have all these sports activities, and you've worked on the culture of the family. Do you think that legalization would change that?
Yes. And I would not want to be a part of that that sociological kind of experiment. No, it was really interesting. I was speaking in April 2016 at United Nations in New York, at UNCAS, where there was a big group fighting for legalization of cannabis and marijuana and decriminalization of owning substances and having substances. And that was kind of a breaking point, because suddenly where I was talking, I had a full, like, hundreds of people coming in from a different angle and saying, we cannot make this happen. We have to prevent this. So we actually have now around the world a strong, like, coalition of people who want to prevent substance use among young people.
What is that coalition?
Well, it's all over the world. So it's different in different societies. Okay. It's driven by different, in some societies, it's the medical association who contacts us. It's parent groups. It's, a lot of people around the world.
And they contact you personally or your research group or who?
They contact my research group and me. Yeah. Oh, so, yeah. So it's, yeah.
So now it's easy to say, okay, you're in Iceland, your population is 375,000 people. It's not as diverse maybe as other countries. You can maybe do this wonderful model in Iceland, but how does that apply to any other country?
Well, actually, we've done tests on it in different places. In Lithuania, which has a very different kind of policy when it comes to buying substances or buying alcohol. We've tested it in Spain, we've tested it in Chile, and we're testing it in more societies, and it turns out that it works. And if we use the same methods. So yes, it's not because we're so strange up here north in this volcanic island.
So let's take one of those areas that you mentioned, pick a country, like, I don't know if you said Chile. Is it all of Chile or is it just like one community that you focused on? And do they have, laws there that are legalized marijuana or protect, and alcohol for kids? Is the culture already protective or not?
Actually, Chile was the second country outside of Iceland that took this model and implemented it like country wise. So it's the model is run in the whole of Chile.
Wow.
You know. And so, but in many other countries, it's based on communities and cities. We work a lot with mayors, people who are in charge of communities. But Chile was the second country and has been kind of a key, like, yeah, just a role model showing that this works outside of Iceland in a very, very different society.
Do you have, I don't know that you don't have your data in front of you, but can you give us like a ballpark idea of how you measured that? Is it alcohol? Is it like Iceland's dramatic number of 48% to 5% alcohol binge drinking? Is it use alcohol or cannabis, or what did you measure in Chile?
We do the studies, the comparative studies, the same in all the countries. Whether we're working in like Iceland or in Guinea-Bissau in Africa, or in Santiago in Chile, the studies are always the same. So we do studies every other year, we see the same trend in these different societies. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So it's
is your measurement similar to what we have in the United States, like the NISDA study or the Monitoring the Future, where they do these huge questionnaires to youth? Wow. Is it the same type of thing?
No. Honestly, actually, our studies when we were starting this in 1996-97, we monitoring the future was kind of our Bible. So it was our so that that's a key book in my bookshelf. Monitoring the future was what we used as a role model.
Right. Now, what are you seeing in areas, and maybe Europe is closer to you, but also, I mean, we could save the discussion to the United States in a bit, but where cannabis is legal, there's a push to normalize drug use. What do you see is happening in terms of use and prevention in those areas?
I can only give you one story.
Okay.
I was telling you this the story from Ungass in where I was speaking in New York in April 2016.
And tell us what Ungass is. I don't think we know what that stands for.
Well, it was a United Nations at the time. There was a pressure on legalizing marijuana and cannabis, and Ungass was, I mean, the United Nations, you know, we have talks about prevention there every year, and so there was this person who stood up in the crowd when I had been speaking. And she was from Denver, Colorado, where they had just kind of legalized marijuana. And she was a high school teacher in a school for kind of disprivileged kids, you know, kids who are brought up in poverty. And she was so driven, like many of these people who give their lives into just like investing in these kids who do not have the same possibilities as others. And she, after my speech, she stood up and she was crying. And she just pledged to us, she pleaded, she said, just like, please do not legalize, because, you know, we've been fighting. She had been a high school teacher for years, for decades. And she said, we have saved so many lives, and we've gotten them on the right track. But now, after the legalization of marijuana, we completely lost them. They show up, but they are not there.
It's been a failed public health experiment, and I don't know if we've even measured that count. But I don't know if you know, but I'm an emergency physician, and every single shift, I'm in San Diego, take care of marijuana poisonings every shift. Psychosis, cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, suicidal ideations, heart effects, drug interactions, everything. And we've and shown in huge studies, the association with psychosis. And the products that we're selling are nothing like the European products, right? They're some really high potency, genetically engineered plants, and also these shatters in DAO, like 90% THC, things that the supply, and I don't know if you've seen this in your research, supply matters. If you have a lot of supply of fentanyl, then the drug is fentanyl. We don't have heroin as much, so we don't have as much heroin, right? So it's supply.
Supply matters, you know.
Yeah.
Keep the supply down, and because supply is a key risk factor, you know, the more there is.
I love hearing you say that.
Get it, the more likelihood of using it.
Yeah. You know. And I don't know, and I will be in Vienna in April for the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. I don't know if that's something that you attend, but marijuana is always the center of discussion around the world.
I'll probably be there. So
you'll be there? Together. Oh, yeah. Okay. Hopefully I'll meet you in person. Yay.
Yeah. So we'll be there together.
Okay. That's awesome. We'll connect. Wow. How exciting. I get to meet you in person. and learn more. And as you see from the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, the discussion, were you there last year, by the way?
Yes, I was there last year. Yeah.
So did you see the guy, there was a group going around at the commission, and they were pro marijuana, and they were, you know, they had a guy there who was, he was wearing a veteran's hat, and it said California, and he was talking about, how marijuana is important to him as a veteran. I don't know if you remember seeing that guy. He stood up because he wore that hat everywhere. But anyway, it was fake news because he was not an American veteran wearing an American veteran hat. But that's a discussion. I was really surprised that the discussion at the United Nations was so focused just on marijuana and not with fentanyl and the fake pills, because the United States is, 300 people a day are dying from fentanyl. Let's talk about, before we go to the United States, international drug prevention. You're very focused on that. You're leading a commission with our own, you were mentioning our Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, about the threat of synthetic drugs. Tell us about what you're doing with that. It's beyond a threat. We're under attack on synthetic drugs. Fentanyl is a synthetic drug in the United States. I don't know if that's a threat to Iceland or Europe, but tell us what you're doing with that.
Well, it's a huge effort, that was created in July 2023, and we have three different groups. So we are working around the world, and I am a co-chair of one of these groups that is focused on drug prevention, but the two other groups are, one of them is just focused on fentanyl and how to deal with that threat in the US. That group has been very successful. We're working hard, the meetings are, they have people from all over the world. And so, it's optimistic,
Interesting. We're parents who've lost their children to fentanyl are really angry, as they should be. And there's one group, Families Against Fentanyl, that wants to declare fentanyl, illicit fentanyl, not the kind that I use in the hospital, but illicit fentanyl, a weapon of mass destruction, in order to give the American government the full power to go after the supply chain, because again, supply matters. So I don't know if that's on the discussion table. Maybe you may.
It is on the discussion table. Yes, absolutely. I'm co-chair of just one of these three groups, but this is a very active, as in like we have, like governments from like 1,300 government representatives from 146 countries to address the threat of synthetic drugs. So
now when you're talking about synthetic drugs, do you also include the now, you know, push to legalize the psychedelics, which are synthetic drugs, and the various cannabinoid products? We have all these semi-synthetic marijuana products now that are technically legal around the United States.
Yeah. So because I'm a co-chair of the drug prevention group.
Yeah.
I don't want to say exactly what is being discussed in the other groups, but I'm sure that they are including all of this.
All those things. Yeah. All right. So as the world's prevention expert, looking at what's happening in the United States, I'd love to hear your opinion. On one hand, we do have active people who are working on drug prevention. On the other hand, and I think it's a bigger hand, there's a push to normalize, commercialize drugs. It's on billboards everywhere. It's in the media. It's in the movies. So you have these two opposing forces, and it seems like one is winning over the other.
Well, I've always said that, you know, these guys who are in this for the money and the marketing, the market is smart. The people who are marketing these drugs are smart. You know, they know what they're doing. So we need to be smarter, and we need to collaborate. We need to be like stronger together. And that is probably what we have lacked, because we have been fighting just like individually or in groups in different places, while the market is very targeted and very like organized. And so I'm a born optimist. I do think that is changing now. I do think that we are definitely coming up with something like Dan Heath's book, Upstream, The Quest to Solve Problems Before They Happen. So that is what we need to collaborate on.
Yes. What about, so again, ask in Iceland, because you've been so successful in your prevention, you don't have the things that we're pushing in the United States right now, which is we have 16 naloxone vending machines in around San Diego County, just because people are overdosing and we just want them to be able to get naloxone. You just go in like a candy machine with no money and just get naloxone. We're pushing harm reduction. We're pushing treatment as we should. Do you have those kind of things where you are? Have you even heard of them?
Yeah. No, we do. We do have harm reduction. We do have in our work, it doesn't say that, you know, we need to treat the people who are already in there. You know, we need to help the people who are already in there. But by long-term thinking, and this means thinking 20 years ahead, and that is sometimes difficult to get politicians on board, as in, you know, but we can prevent this, but it's not something that is going to happen today and tomorrow. It may happen in a year or even just in 2 years. You can show good results. And but we definitely, we are also treating the ones who are in, you know, have problems.
Who have a medical problem, right?
Yeah.
And I like what you say. It's not one campaign. You know, you're not going to have a billboard and fix the problem. You mentioned a quiet revolution. I like how you say that.
It's not a campaign. It's a quiet revolution.
Yeah. And I say, we're not going, you know, they say we're not going to arrest our way out of the drug problem. Okay. But I say we're also not going to naloxone, or we're not going to treat our way out of the drug problem, but we can prevent. And you've been the world's role model on showing that that is possible.
Yeah. So it is possible. And so we can do it, but we have to do it together.
Yes.
The whole world.
World Coalition, United Nations. Yes. All right. I can't wait to meet you in person.
No, same. Will be wonderful. So I'll see you soon.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ingadora, Sigfus daughter. I think I said that right.
Perfect.
And for your role model, for your science, for your heart, for your hope in making the world a better place for young people. That's what we want.
Yeah, that's what we want. That's what we share. So yeah. Looking forward to seeing you in Vienna.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.